Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Corn growers have really done a nice job trying to catch up on planting after one of the slowest planting years ever. During this past week, they got another 14% of the crop planted. So as we start the week, 86% of the corn is in the ground.
And remarkably, after everything we've been through this spring, that is just one percentage point behind the five-year average pace of 87%.
But USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says even though we are close to the five-year planting average, we're still tied with the 2011 season for the second slowest corn planting pace in this century, because that five-year average contains the super slow 2019 season when only 62% of the corn was planted by the end of May. Now, for soybeans,
we are making up ground. We haven't quite caught up to the five-year average pace,
but close at 66% planted, the average 67. Rippey says there are some states like Iowa and Illinois where growers are well ahead of the average planting pace. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
I believe a transformed food system will make it easier to adapt to and mitigate the severe consequences of a changing climate whilst not sacrificing agricultural production, by reducing the carbon footprint of food production.
That's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on what a transformed food system looks like.
I believe a transformed food system will deliver a better deal for farmers, ranchers, and growers and consumers through more, new, and better markets, also stimulating our rural economy. I believe a transformed food system will also lead to better health outcomes for Americans by increasing access to healthy, locally grown foods, lowering health care costs for all. I believe a transformed food system will sustainably produce more food, allowing the United States to meet its global responsibility through exports and donations to ensure global food security.
But maybe next time we think of USA, we need to think of a United State of Agriculture.
And it pains me at times when we have this conversation about food and agriculture in this country that seeks to pit one aspect of agriculture against the other, or seeks to demonize certain aspects of agriculture. That's not where I see us headed. I see us headed towards a transformed food system that recognizes the contribution of diverse forms of agriculture, that recognizes the importance of food production to our very being, that recognizes the importance of how it can, in fact, and should link rural and urban centers. There's no reason why you can't have a farm in a city. You ought to have a farm in a city because it does connect people to their food system. There's no sense why we can't collectively work together to make sure that healthy foods are more accessible to more people, because it's in our collective best interest for that to happen. If we can save folks from chronic disease, if we can save folks from having to have dialysis, that's going to save not just them, it's going to save all of us. And so this work is just incredibly important, that we all row and work in the same direction, because I think there's unlimited possibilities and potential for a transformation of our system so that indeed we do have a sustainable agriculture that gets to net zero. We do have a way in which farmers can see that they can make a living and pass it on to the next generation. We do have expanded access to healthy choices for everybody, not just the fortunate few that can afford to go to some of the higher-end grocery stores, but to everybody having that access, that we do have a food bank and food pantry system that has access to the same level of delicious foods that we can get, so that folks don't feel as they've been left out or left behind. That's what this is all about. That's what this transformed system and the investments we make today and the investments we made over the last year, that's the goal here, is to have that kind of system where we all can take pride in that system. So I'm looking forward to working with all of the folks who are watching this today and all the folks in the food and agriculture industry to make this transformation happen, because I think it's in the best interest of our country. And I think, frankly, agriculture can not only lead the way from an environmental perspective and an economic sustainability perspective, but I do believe, as I think Haley may have mentioned, that it is a way in which we can reconnect with one another, a way in which we can rediscover community in this country, to break down this divisiveness that is making it so difficult for us to accept and deal with some of the other big challenges we face as a country. So I hope you all see the magnitude and the importance of this work, and that we work together to make it happen.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Well, maybe. I mean, you look at what it costs to actually produce fuel. You know, it's not pocket change to add more capacity to the U.S. refinery system. So it's a big commitment for dollar-wise, and companies have to look at, you know, what's my long-term prospects if I open up new capacity. And, you know, right now there seems to be a big push for going battery power and green energy. So I don't know if we're ever going to get that capacity back.
Just 2 weeks ago, average U.S. on-highway retail diesel fuel price, $5.61 per gallon. That's a $2 increase from January 3rd. And although retail diesel prices increasing across the entire U.S., it's the prices in the Northeast that have increased the most, now among the highest in the country. Greg Ibendahl is with Kansas State. Are exports aiding the higher prices, Ibendahl says?
Well, I've read some analysis that says, you know, we're exporting more fuel, diesel fuel, to Mexico because that is probably our main export market for diesel fuel, and that has made the problem worse. But really, going back and looking at the historical numbers, I don't really see that being a factor. We're kind of exporting, to me, it looks like historical norms as far as diesel fuel. I think the supply problem can be traced back to looking at the capacity issues and the utilization issues, and that has really just created low inventory levels, and that's why we're seeing the high prices right now.
And one lingering question is, how long will these high prices remain?
Well, unfortunately, I think we're going to have high prices, probably, you know, gas probably in the upper $3 to $4 range for quite a while, because, you know, both gasoline and diesel fuel are tied back to the price of oil, and oil prices right now, you know, they're like in the 110 to 120 range. They've been ever since the Russian-Ukraine thing kind of started. So, you know, depending on what happens there, I don't really see the oil price necessarily going down. I guess you could always have a, you know, a big recession that would cause things to go down. And again, you know, one of the economists saying is, you know, the cure for $4 gas is $4 gas. That could put us back into recessions. But barring that, I think you're going to be looking at, and the economy, assuming it stays like what it is, we're probably going to look at, you know, oil prices where they are. And again, that's going to translate to probably, again, $4 gas and the appropriate levels of diesel fuel. But, you know, since we are quite a bit above what the predicted price should be based on the price of oil, I think as refineries amp up their utilization percentages and start to make a little more diesel fuel, you are going to see that margin between gas and diesel come down more closer to historical norms. Now, the EIA is saying that's going to take probably through fall before that even starts to occur. And even when that does happen, it's still going to be probably just a little bit higher than where it should be. So I really expect diesel to kind of come down over the summer, maybe into fall to some degree, and that price differential will go away. But again, we're probably still looking at $4 gas, probably at least through the end of the year, at least, depending, you know, again, if a recession happens or not. But we're going to see a little bit of improvement in diesel, but it's still going to be high.
So at this point, producers dealing with high energy prices, but what about fertilizer cost and net farm income?
Yeah, I'm going to be working up another analysis for that. Again, my model for fertilizer looks at the corn price, the oil price, and inflation. All those have kind of stayed pretty high ever since my last analysis. So really, I don't really see much relief in fertilizer prices probably for the next year again at that rate. So producers are probably going to have to look at, you know, that $1,500 anhydrous ammonia price out there and just plan on that for next fall, next spring's crop. So far, they have kept up, and, you know, my forecast for net farm income really hasn't shown much of a decrease because of that, mainly because commodity prices are still high. But again, it wouldn't take much to change that situation. If, you know, we have overproduction for some reason and commodity prices drop, then farmers could be facing a situation of, you know, real high input prices and maybe not so great output prices, and that would not do well for net farm income.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think it's important to start with the fact that, you know, we all identify the SEC Southeastern Conference because we've never been regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission before. The agricultural industry, by and large, is not subject to SEC regulation.
Yeah, those three-letter federal agencies have not been real friendly to ag in the past, whether it's IRS, EPA, or now SEC. Mary Thomas Hart is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
The SEC was created to regulate publicly traded entities and to manage and enforce laws against market manipulation. So because most of the agricultural industry isn't publicly traded, we're not subject to those rules. But in recent years, shareholders for these publicly traded companies have been more and more interested in getting information from the supply chains of the companies for which they partly own. And the SEC has attempted to provide that information by proposing some different regulations that aim to get further down the supply chain and get information beyond those publicly traded entities. And this is just the latest example of that, but it's the first time that agricultural producers could really be implicated by a reporting requirement from the SEC. So back in March, the SEC proposed a rule that would require mandatory greenhouse gas emissions reporting from all publicly traded entities. Now, that includes scope one, or direct emissions, scope two, or emissions from gas and electricity generation, and scope three, or supply chain emissions. So now when we talk about scope three emissions, we're talking about any publicly traded company that sells beef being required to submit reports on greenhouse gas emissions to the federal government from the U.S. cattle production supply chain. And that poses a few issues for cattle producers. First, you know, there is no accurate way to collect this information. The EPA has been working to develop emissions estimation methodology for years. And then secondly, you know, I think the fact that we aren't able to accurately disclose that information puts us at potential legal liability from those publicly traded companies or their shareholders.
Of course, many in ag already know that regulatory burdens in ag rarely accomplish the goal.
We've dealt with this issue before, right, in terms of CERCLA mandatory reporting or EPCRA mandatory reporting requirements. All of those, you know, are different laws with some kind of different requirements, but at the core, the issue is the same. The federal government is asking for information that isn't available and isn't easy come up with, and so it puts an additional burden on farmers and ranchers across the country to, one, kind of do the paperwork to figure out their emissions, and then submit those reports to a publicly traded company that will then turn around and submit those reports to the federal government. And if those reports aren't accurate, then we put ourselves at liability, you know, of being sued by companies or by their shareholders. And honestly, I think, you know, when we talk about the fact that farmers and ranchers could be required to submit inaccurate information to these companies, it honestly seems like a disservice to those shareholders, because it seems irresponsible to be mandated by the federal government to provide no information that we know is inaccurate. And if I were a shareholder, I would rather have no information than incorrect information, which is what they're going to end up with.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Now, the pandemic exposed many weaknesses and vulnerabilities of our food supply system, but no more so than in the meat and poultry processing industry.
That's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
You know, at one point during the pandemic, animals had to be euthanized simply because processing plants were shut down and there was no place to market the animals. The president started this year with a call to action to use the American Rescue Plan resources to expand processing capacity and create more competition for the four major processors which dominate the markets for beef, poultry, and pork processing. Initially, investments of $32 million were quickly made at USDA to 167 small and mid-sized independent plants across the country, allowing them to make improvements so that they could begin selling across state lines. An additional $23 million will be awarded very soon in this program at sometime this year. At the same time, we also launched a $100 million food supply chain loan guarantee program that Morgan referred to. This fund was established to make it easier for small and mid-sized processing and supply chain companies to access the credit they need for warehousing, cold storage, and mobile slaughter units. To date, several loan guarantees have been funded, and a number are awaiting approval. In partnership with lenders, USDA is investing up to $275 million to provide grants of up to $15 million to create a number of multiple revolving loan funds that will help small and mid-sized independent processing plants. These loan funds will provide needed capital to address the future plans these plants have to expand, to improve, or to retain existing capacity. Finally, using ARP funds, USDA will fund the Meat and Poultry Processing Expansion Program. We initially announced $150 million in grants. This is going to grow to $325 million by the end of the year. These grant monies will help to build new independent processing capacity or expand existing independent processing capacity. For this program, we've already received over 250 applications for grants totaling almost $900 million in requests, again, from all regions of the country. While strengthening existing plants, making additions to new and expanded plants, the meat and poultry industry, it will make our system far more resilient, will build it back better, and make it more able to withstand the shocks of a resurgent pandemic or any other significant disruption.
But also says there are other areas of concern in our supply chain.
The pandemic and ensuing inflation caused by supply chain disruptions and Putin's war against Ukraine underscores the difficulty of providing healthy and nutritious food for all when markets are disrupted. The pandemic also exposed for us how many food banks and pantries had difficulty accepting fresh fruits and vegetables or dairy products due to a lack of warehousing and refrigeration capacity. In our view, a transformed food system needs to be better equipping those food banks and pantries, as the important cog in the food system they are, to help families financially struggling access those healthy foods. For that reason, USDA established the Reach and Resiliency Grant Program, and under this program, USDA is investing with its food bank and pantry partners $100 million to expand warehousing and refrigeration capacity in food banks and pantries across the United States. And we've already accepted 39 applications for these resources. These grants will also help food banks and pantries better serve the needs of rural families living in remote areas by ensuring that they too will have access to food and assistance from those food pantries and food banks.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Our initial look at cotton condition, 44% of the crop rated good to excellent, 18% very poor to poor.
So Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA, takes a look at crop condition ratings each week.
And there's only two states really jumping out in terms of lower conditions. Unfortunately, one of those is Texas, the big cotton state. 29% of the crop rated very poor to poor in the initial report. The other state with lower cotton conditions on this first report of the season, Missouri, 21% very poor to poor. The problem there is actually wetness. So we'd like to see some drier, warmer weather moving into the northern Mississippi Delta.
So when it comes to the cotton crop on the high plains, we turn to Mark Brown with Plains Cotton Growers.
We're visiting with a lot of producers and gin managers as well, and we're seeing a whole lot of field activity out there right now. We're kind of moving along at a fevered pitch out in the fields. Tony, we've finally, thank goodness, in many places gotten some much-needed rainfall. You know, across our entire service area, it's been extremely dry. We've been in as much as exceptional drought in certain counties of our 42-county service area. Over the last week, the last full week of May, we did receive some much-needed rainfall in many areas. It's certainly going to be helpful, especially where we've got some irrigation capabilities, and that's going to help with catch-up on that irrigation. Now, the question is going to be, since we are so dry, so deep, the question would be in most cases, is there going to be enough moisture to not only germinate a crop, but to keep a crop going? And that's something that only time will tell. So we did get rainfall during that last full week of May. I heard reports anywhere from around a half an inch up to more than 3 inches in some places. And as usual, during this that came with some storm damage. We had several places where people received some large hail, high winds that caused damage, and even in some instances, we saw some tornadic activity. I know one particular place in Terry County where they experienced a tornado that was out in the middle of nowhere, except that it did cross and pull a portion of a roof off of a home. So there was some damage out across the area. We are at May 31st deadline, and so people in those northern counties are lining up today with that being the cotton crop insurance deadline for planting, and then from Hale County down through Lubbock County and that tier of counties through that direction, we're looking at a June 5th deadline, and then of course June 10th from Linn County on south. We do have a few counties just off the edge of the Cap Rock, and many of those counties have an extended deadline out to June 20th. Just because of their geographic location. So lots of field activity right now. We've seen a lot of sand fighting and seen a lot of planters running here lately trying to meet those deadlines.
That's Mark Brown, Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been holding a lot firmer than I thought it might.
Caitlin McCulloch is director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
And so I think the narrow range is relatively a good sign, especially when you have the volume of cattle on feed that we do, especially over 120 days. We saw a little bit of weakness last week. As you mentioned, we dipped below 140 for the five area. But then this Friday, it closed back above 140. So I'm pretty optimistic about what that says about what the packers are seeing on their end. Now, you have seen the packer margin compress quite a bit as wholesale box beef hasn't quite followed upwards that much. And so really they're continuing to pay up for cattle through their own margins. Now, box beef increased about 1% over the week before, but rib primal value relatively stable. Loin and short plate saw the greatest increase of both about 2% over the prior week. Now, the short plate one has been one we're watching is this export market, China specifically. We're wondering how COVID lockdowns are affecting them and what's that going to do to beef demand, because we have seen considerable weakness on the pork side of things. On the domestic demand side, at least where I'm at and for a lot of the upper Midwest, it hasn't been that warm. And so grilling season, they've been a little bit slow to take off, but it does seem like we've seen gains here in the near term, which might be kind of supportive for fed cattle. But normally we would see fed cattle prices decline pretty aggressively in June. And I can't underline that enough, because the number of cattle on feed is so very large, approaching what we've seen in the last 2 years as some of the peak points. I'm putting that June figure closer to 132, 133. That's a long way to fall at this point, $9 or so, but that's what the normal seasonal pattern would do. And I think that's going to make sense with where we're at in terms of the cattle on feed cycle as well. On the feeder side of things, Dunk City had a little bit of bump in the heavyweight feeder cattle prices, big gains in 7-8s and 8-9s. That's not all that atypical when you have such a high corn price. They're going to be looking at that cost of gain and getting those animals finished as quickly as possible. You can also see a little bit of weakness in the heifer side of things. We didn't see quite the same gains that we saw on the steer side on those feeder heifers. And so things to watch there. Overall, this high feed cost and drought concerns has taken a little bit of the wind out of the sails of those lightweight cattle. We saw a lot of high demand for lightweight cattle earlier this year. I think once those stocker needs were filled, we've moved past that. The question will be is, can they hold on to them? If there's a lot of drought liquidation on cattle, I would expect those lighter weight calves to get beat back even further.
But what could be ahead for the fed cattle market?
I'm not very optimistic. I think the futures market is a little bit different. It's right now very close to where I have cash cattle being. Mm-hmm. But I think any weakness in that cash market, you can see some reaction from the futures market that might drive it lower, at least for a little bit. In those deferred contracts, I expect a little bit more movement. You're still at 143 on Friday for December. I wouldn't be surprised to see that move a little bit lower, especially as more macroeconomic data comes forward. Well, on the supporting side, box beef has continued to move up. I mean, maybe not as much as we'd like to see in a normal seasonal rally, but it hasn't moved down. And so we're looking at all of those factors that could help support this market from falling further, especially on the future side. But my outlook is that I think cash prices will definitely come down here in the next 5 weeks or so. And the futures market might get tossed around a little bit more by all these other influences.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Additional investments are going to be needed to expand cold storage, warehousing, and other components of an overall processing component of our food system. And we know access to capital can be a main reason why those needed facilities simply are not being built.
Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack.
For that reason, we announced today that USDA will be making $600 million available in the form of grants and low-interest loans or loan guarantees to build out a supportive infrastructure in a variety of non-meat and poultry food sectors to expand the processing as well as distribution, storage, and aggregation capacity of our system. Our transformed food system will expand capacity and competition and increase that competition in all sectors. And when it does, both producers and consumers will benefit.